Hey, my name's Matt. I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And this is Andrew, and I write for thestopbutton.com.
And you're listening to an Alan Smithy podcast. Today, we're going to do 30 minutes each on one good movie we know and one bad movie you knew. I didn't know, but I always knew it was bad, Mannequin.
You've never
seen... one. The good one was Terminator 2.
And that'll be second.
And I think we both just rewatched Mannequin, so I think we're going to be giving our very fresh thoughts on it. And first of all, I mean, I sort of knew a lot about this movie only because they referenced it on Mystery Science Theater 3000 all the time. Like, Crow had a crush on Kim Cattrall, and Tom Servo would go, "Switcher!"
I don't know when the last time I saw it was. I think I've seen it on DVD, and it's been out for 8 or 9 years. So,
It was it was really popular in its day, wasn't it? There was a sequel.
There was a sequel.
Now, stars.
Here's the thing. It was a video hit. It was one of the first video hits, and the sequel was made based upon the video popularity, kind of like how today, you know, the Bourne sequel was made based on the DVD popularity of the first one. But the interesting thing about Mannequin 2, which is really, really bad, and I would say not even watchable. You couldn't even get through the 92 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Is that Entertainment Weekly back in, you know, 1991, 1992, reviewed the Mannequin 2 sequel on video with another sequel that had been made based on video popularity, and it was either Die Hard 2 or Terminator 2 that they paired it with and sort of compared and contrasted Mannequin 2 with one of those other movies.
As a good movie, bad movie type of example?
As a video made... The reason you're seeing these movies is because of video, so we'll review them together. But, yeah, I hadn't seen... So you had never seen Mannequin before?
Nah, you know, slightly before my time. When I was watching it, I was thinking, like, wow, this is really 1987. Like, all these yuppies look like they're about to be shot by RoboCop.
And the Michael Jackson reference with the hat.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
The montages, the, you know, light, breezy pace. A lot of the movie seemed to be in montages, and it wasn't like, I guess in the opening scene with the in Egypt, I thought this is like a Las Vegas show. Like, what if the whole movie is like this? But then it kind of, they kind of go, you kind of see the director going for some slapstick elements that, like, Andrew McCarthy swinging on a sign as an old lady's talking to him
with really bad editing too.
It feels. Yeah, really bad editing. It feels like at least they're making the effort, but then later the bad editing and the bad directing just kind of make the physical comedy about as funny as a Police Academy movie.
And, of course, G.W. Bailey's in it, so there's a Police Academy tie-in.
Yeah, I couldn't remember who he was from Police Academy until I saw him. And then I was like, oh, it's Mauser or Proctor or one of those.
Yeah, one of those two guys.
Yeah, who's always hassling the fun cops. Yeah, it was, you know, it sort of felt easy to watch at first and kind of dragged as it went on. But I was really surprised but that Kim Cattrall was, like, after the intro, she doesn't show up again until 20 minutes later.
Yeah.
And then when she shows up again, then she's gone for 10 minutes. And they tried to really space her out like she was this big thing. It feels like a very deliberate kind of star-making vehicle for her because they're always teasing her.
Yeah, and... Now, so the guys who directed that, or the guys who wrote it, they really, I don't think, really did very much else. But it had an uncredited rewrite by Ken Levine and David Isaacs. And Ken Levine has his blog now. And they both worked on Cheers and Frasier. And they're credited with writing the sequel. And so I had never watched it knowing that. But you watch it now and you see these jokes that are straight out of Cheers and things like that. And I think very much at the end when she's pointing at the guy and saying he's having a nervous breakdown. I felt like it was a Shelley Long moment from Cheers. But my a friend of mine said about Rick Astley once that he's nowhere near as bad as you think he is. And that's kind of how I feel about Mannequin, that, you know, it's no good, but until the sort of Judd Apatow crop of watchable romantic comedies came along, I mean, I think I'd definitely rather watch Mannequin than American Wedding, for example.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess romantic comedies with elements of magic have been around a long time. Like, they could have made this movie in the 40s, possibly, or the 50, or the 50s, more likely. It's kind of an old genre. It just feels like Mannequin feels like a really 1987 version of that. Just like very, very trendy kind of view, you know, depiction of New York and ethnic stereotypes at the state of their art in 87.
But it was in Philadelphia. See, you missed out on that.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and there was even a title card telling you sort of, and the setting of the department store.
Yeah.
As this magical land where you could do anything, where you can have these great montages. And while I agree for the most part the direction's bad, I really do like a couple shots in it, and the Phantom of the Opera one. Like, I was like, that's a fine shot, like, for this guy who probably learned how to direct from a commercial, if he was lucky. And and then the really bad acting from Andrew McCarthy's ex-girlfriend. I think they were trying to put her as Rosalind Russell or something. Like the hysterical second string female lead.
Her whole subplot with that Armand guy was really annoying. Like, that guy kept smiling at his own bits, and even when his character was supposed to be upset. There's a lot of bad subplots in this movie. I mean, I think G.W. Bailey was probably the funniest on his own merits all of them.
Oh yeah, I mean, the end when he has the breakdown screaming she's the mannequin. I always have remembered that as the moment where I started cracking up when I've seen this, because you know, I grew up in the 80s, so I saw this on video in 88, and you know, just. So I always remember just not being able to handle him, because it's just, for some reason, it was just so funny to me. And so it was kind of nice to see that I still found him really funny.
Yeah, he is funny. He's got a great face, and he could have played tough guys in movies seriously, but he just plays tough guys for comedy in Police Academy.
Yeah, and well, he's now on The Closer, and that's what I thought it was funny, because you had him and you had James Spader, who's on Boston Legal.
Yeah, James Spader,
and this is like the thing where if you wanted to mess with James Spader, you just show that shot of him with the mannequin's butt in his face.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so embarrassing. And I remember, oh man, I don't remember what movie he was giving the interview for, but it was after Stargate. And he gave some interview where he said he never watched the movies he appeared in. And I'm like, well, that's how you can be in Stargate. And I'm like, but wait, you've never seen what you looked like? In Mannequin, like, did he not even see the dailies of him in those glasses that take up half of his face, and you know, he's got on pasty.
Yeah, he was like, he was the one I kept expecting to get shot by an Ed 209.
And who else is in it? That the Stel Getty was really bad.
Tolerable. I mean, she wasn't in the movie all that much.
No, she wasn't. And it's like you're watching it and you're like, okay, so I think Estelle Getty's in this, so they can put her in the commercial, and then she will be on the commercial on TV during the Golden Girls, and your Golden Girls watchers will be like, oh, let's go see Mannequin.
Well, yeah, and I agree. I think the reason this genre's been around a long time, it's kind of a woman's movie. They would kind of put Estelle Getty in to appeal to that demographic, and that's why it's an old genre, because it's kind of a magical fairy tale thing, and Andrew McCarthy is very non-threatening as a lead comedic performance, and you got montages of playing dress up the song at the end and credits was nominated for it was nominated for an Oscar.
See, and I don't even like that song. Like, I like the other montage song. I thought the other montage song was fine. Like, it was amusing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of like the opening title song, and I like the opening titles animation by Sally Creekshank, I think is the name of the animator. She also did animated openings for Ruthless People, Top Secret, Sesame Street in the 80s. She had a pretty distinct style. It's pretty of the time in 87.
Yeah, I mean, it's to some degree, when I watch Mannequin, I actually do wonder when it has its successes, I guess I'd say, how these people came up with that. Because, you know, the opening titles don't really fit the movie itself, but they're good. So somebody must have hired her to do it and thought she was going to do a good job. And so, I'm trying to think of something else.
It's really, you know, polished looking. It's lit very vividly and brightly.
And I was surprised I'd never heard of the cinematographer. I thought it was, who was his name? He shoots for TV Now. He shot The West Wing and Studio 60. Thomas Del Ruth. It looks very 80s in that sort of bright, wet concrete sort of way.
Yeah, the neons were very, they were burning so bright, they were burning out at the end of the decade until they finally stopped in the, you know, mid-90s, I guess.
Now, the guy who played Armand has not actually gone on to much.
Oh, good. I'm glad that he didn't.
he actually had one funny line. I can't remember what it was. That distasteful sex line, that is out of, that I think that would be... those two sitcom writers writing the detestable sex line for some reason. It just seemed very NBC, look what we can get past the censors type thing.
Kinda, yeah.
What was it? Have you ever seen Lady Beware?
No, I never heard of it.
Okay. It's Diane Lane. It's from 1987. And I think I saw it because I was working at a video store and Leonard Maltin pointed out that it was from a female it was a thriller from a female perspective type thing. And you watch it and it's set in Pittsburgh. So it's set on the other side of Pennsylvania. And it is about a window dresser at a department store who does up the mannequins. And so it's just that, like,
Leonard Maltin corroborates my point pretty well, I think. Yeah, it's a window dresser is a very non-threatening male lead for a movie targeted at women.
Yeah. Well, I guess according to IMDb's trivia notes, it was supposed to be Dudley Moore. And then, because you know, the thing, I am not a big Andrew McCarthy detractor, because he's kind of harmless.
Yeah, he is too harmless to hate. He's like Judge Reinhold or something.
Yeah, and he did do one somewhat interesting movie in the late 90s called I'm Losing You, which was this L.A. movie. And, I mean, there was some interesting stuff in it, but trying to think. In some of the scenes in this, you just get the feeling that, because I think this is his only really, I mean, he made some really terrible movies at the end of the 80s, but until this point, he was making better class of Brat Pack movies than this. I hate to compliment San Elmo's Fire, but it certainly was a higher profile project than this.
Yeah, and I guess they figured, hey, this guy's on fire when he's with lifeless bodies. So let's put him in Weekend at Bernie's 1 and 2. And was that another video hit that led to a unnecessary sequel?
No, Weekend at Bernie's 1 was a theatrical hit, and that's what led to a second one. Weekend at Bernie's 1 was a hit in the summer of 89. I mean, it made, I think, like $39 million, and that was 1989, and it was budgeted at, what, like 4? So yeah, no, that was a real hit, like, if you can believe it.
Yeah, looks like the last Brat Pack movie he did was right after Mannequin with Less Than Zero.
Yeah, and that was like one of the last ones. But then he did this movie with Matt Dillon called Kansas, which is one of the worst movies I've ever watched 20 minutes of. But in this one, he kind of does the slapstick okay, I think, because you can tell he's actually having a good time. And I think that...
pretty much everybody does, I think.
Yeah, and especially during that chase scene at the end. And I think that's kind of what must have been some of the appeal of it, is that, you know, when you go to a fancy department store, it'd be funny to imagine it being wrecked by a huge chase scene.
And when you see a stand of fruit on the street, it'd be funny to imagine a car hitting it.
Hey. It's like the A-Team. It was the 80s, you know?
The whole dance montage where they're trying on costumes, like I get how that's clever enough. It could have been written by Frasier writers, right? That they like, that's why they're dressing up in different clothes.
You think they came up with that? I don't know.
No, probably.
I don't think so.
Probably not.
Did you notice when she's on the hang glider?
Oh, that was really bad. That
her
was
outfit changes when she lands.
That made the, you know, some, you know, moderate competence of the swinging sign thing early in the movie seemed like a fluke, because it didn't feel like it was happening at all with the hang glider.
No,
not happening.
How do you swing?
How do you fly around in a hang glider inside that mall was, you know, it had a tall ceiling, but it seemed pretty narrow.
Yeah, she'd have trouble orbiting up there without plummeting really fast.
Pretty fakey, but yeah. The movie doesn't have too much fakiness. I was expecting like a really bad kind of either blue lightning that you see as an optical effect in a lot of 80s movies, or maybe like pink, bright, wormy, you know, electricity during a transformation scene. But no, they just, you know, had her pop into frame like they would have in an old movie or something. Just, you know, surprise you with it.
When I was watching it, I was trying to imagine how it would have played if... I mean, obviously, Michael Gottlieb wasn't going to do this in 1987, but when Soderbergh did, I haven't seen it, but he tried to make a movie like Michael Curtiz would.
Uh-huh.
Remember The Good German? He shot at 1:37, tried to, you know, mimic making a movie in the 40s in a studio environment. And I mean, when you watch Mannequin, you can kind of see how it would... They seem to think that that's what they're doing, and then you have Michael Jackson references, and you have the Rambo references, the Terminator references, and they really date it, because the way they do it is so bad.
Pretty much everything about the movie is dated, and that makes it seem like it might be a little tackier and tasteless than it actually is. Mostly it's just like genteel and good-natured. I mean, even, you know, even with Hollywood if Hollywood Montrose is like the edgiest thing in your movie, then sailing pretty clear water.
I started it, and then I stopped it for a little bit before I finished it, and I was telling my wife that I'm convinced that the presence of Hollywood in this movie sort of made homosexuals more acceptable in the late 80s, because he's so innocuous, or however you pronounce the word that I probably just mispronounced. I mean, he's such a, it's just the way they do it. He's so clearly all right, and the bad guys are so clearly bad. It's
When he shows up, like, I winced a little when he ends his introductory scene by saying, I thought I was the weird one around here. And then immediately the very next scene after his intro is G.W. Bailey being called
a bigot.
Yeah. I can't remember if he said bigot or prejudiced or just, you know, whatever. But they, you know, they absolve them. So they put in that safety lock in the very next scene, and just to reassure you.
Now, there was one scene that I wanted to admit. The Maitre D scene, that felt very Cheers writer, Frasier writer, sitcom-y, the banter between Andrew McCarthy and the Maitre D. Remember that? About how he couldn't believe he was dining there or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a good talking
scene. I'm looking at IMDb right now, and according to this, there was a real person playing one of the mannequins in the photo window scene. Okay, I gotta mention that you know, I've probably seen this movie an embarrassing amount of times since, you know, the first time I saw it, I was 11 or 10. But the mannequin doesn't look like Kim Cattrall, does it?
No.
No. And they change mannequins throughout. Like, it just... I mean, it's just like you're watching it, and I'm like, I can actually... One of the weird things about it is you can see it being remade today, but as a genre picture...
Right, with special electricity.
With special electricity, but then with some sort of reasoning behind how the transformation works. Because during the motorcycle montage, which I thought was cool that we paired this with a Terminator movie, because motorcycles are so important in both films.
Yeah, they are. Edward Furlong could have been a stunt rider for a mannequin.
Did you see that? And bad stunt doubles. Did you see that terrible motorcycle riding stunt guy?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah,
I liked when comedies still had big action scenes, or just not even action, just big chases thrown into them, and they'd have to use stunt doubles for the actors, as and then cut to them inside the car doing their bits as they're being pulled by a tractor.
But I mean, okay, so let's pretend for a second it's kind of real, and this is where I think they had problems updating a 1930s 1940s slapstick to 1987.
Mm.
If you saw a man, you can't make a mannequin flip you off. That's not how they work. You can't make the mannequins close their eyes. Mm-hmm. You can't style them like that. I mean, I have a problem watching this and going, well, they should realize something's going on, because, you know.
I was wrong. That was the edgiest thing, that more than Hollywood Montrose.
Would be the flipping off mannequin?
Yeah.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. And that's a trailer moment to me. I can see them getting away with that in a theatrical trailer.
Did they do that in Return of the Living Dead 2, where the zombie hand flips it off?
Yeah. I don't know.
Can't remember or not. But that movie, I think that movie was like PG-13 almost. It was almost PG-13, nearly. So it was probably, it's acceptable for mannequin. Definitely.
I'm looking at the, since you mentioned the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
Now, it won Best Actor at FantaFest.
It was screened as a fantasy film.
Director.
Yeah.
And Best Film. And so my only question for this.
Come on, in 1987?
Hold on, I'm looking at what else was up. The year before, Reanimator won.
Wow.
My only question for this is, did Andrew McCarthy accept his award?
Did he? He pulled a Shatner and went, get a life!
I mean, because this FantaFest, it's in Italy. Oh, I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did. I mean, why wouldn't you go to Italy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess that answers
Didn't the sequel try to expand the mythos a little bit?
No, the sequel.
Did it just create new mythos?
It created all new mythos. The mannequin came to life all the time, and everybody could see the mannequin, and there was a magic necklace that turned the mannequin back into a mannequin, and it wasn't really a mannequin, it was...
That's right, it was a neck... I think I confused... Because they played both of these on Comedy Central. They probably played Mannequin 2 on the move more than the first one on TV, so I kept expecting the magic necklace to show up in this one.
No, and there's... I actually was watching the end of it when... we'll spoil it. There's a happy ending where she becomes real for everybody. And I actually did like that, how when they talked about her condition, I guess we'll call it. It kind of reminded me of Lon Chaney always talking about being a werewolf in the old Universal ones, because you couldn't really laugh at it, because, you know, there was something about the performance that made you take it seriously, no matter how silly it was. And I think that they did that all right in this. But I thought they like cut a scene on the DVD where she like prays to the gods to turn her into a person. Apparently they just were paying attention during the exciting conclusion, which I think is the most slapsticky moment, and not slapsticky, but the most successful 1940s comedy moment in the movie, when the entire cast appears for no reason in a room. Yeah. Everything gets resolved in 4 minutes.
And the bad guy gets pulled away, pointing and shouting wildly. It got that feeling sometimes, and it went for that. So it's a successful movie for the kind of movie that it was supposed to be and who it was for, and people liked it, and that's okay.
We have another 5 minutes. What are we going to talk about for another 5 minutes? Because we can't give up on our first.
Oh, I had a few other observations. I thought it was funny that Andrew McCarthy probably would have fucked the mannequin anyways, even if she didn't happen to
be magical,
because the way the plot goes, he's already obsessed with this mannequin in particular, just because he assembled it. And he's looking at it all the time. And
yeah,
it could have been like this, a different movie, but still a comedy with the same first 20 minutes.
I mean, it'd be funny to see it obviously remade with Ashton Kutcher by Mick G, but it'd be just as funny to see it remade by are there any edgy mainstream directors anymore? No.
No.
Like 5 years ago, an edgy mainstream director could have remade this. The guy who made Bad Santa.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could have remade this, and it would have just
Terry's
been
Terry's Wagoff. Yeah, Terry's, this would have been a better movie than Art School Confidential if he had made that movie.
Mike White could have written the script in the
White, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. And
Chuck and Buck.
Chuck and Buck. We could cast Andrew McCarthy as the bad guy or something. And
it's a little too distasteful for Noah Baumbach, but it could be a subplot in a Todd Solondz movie if Todd Solondz is
that'd be good.
Still going strong. He seems to be. He doesn't seem to let anything stop him. Even though it takes him a little while each time. But
the whole approach to being an artist is so 80s simplistic, too. Like, the 80s are so interesting because it's when movies that never would have been made in the 70s somehow started getting made in the 80s, and real theatrical releases, not little ones like say Assault on Precinct 13 had. And because I mean his, like, he's an artist because he makes mannequins and does things with balloon animals and pizzas and turns a shrub into a bunny, and he's like I actually wish there was director's commentary or writer's commentary on how they could conceivably have this guy who had a very nice apartment for never having a job, dating that yuppie, department store girl.
Is there something about his work ethic that says 80s to you?
It's like they always said about, what was it called? Mary. He was a weirdo. Ben Stiller's a weirdo in Something About Mary, but he's basically the leading man in every single 80s movie. He's a guy who just won't give up. Yeah, he just.
Just won't give up, yeah.
And I'm trying to think. Yeah. So what else did you have in a minute and 45 seconds.
I thought the Harold Faltermeyer-esque kind of music was good. I noticed Pat Ryan, who was the mayor in Toxic Avenger and the junkyard owner in Street Trash, which is a fake trauma movie, was a pizza parlor owner in his jobless montage. I had to look up if Hollywood Montrose, the actor, was straight or not, because he reminded me of Larry B. Scott in Revenge of the Nerds. No, he isn't.
He isn't. Okay.
And neither is Larry B. Scott of Revenge of the Nerds.
Okay.
That's about it.
In the last minute five, I will mention that the guy who did the music is Sylvester LeVay, and I only know that because he did the music for that Michael Keaton hockey movie, Touch and Go.
And
that had an awesome score. And this poor guy, he might be working in TV now, but I think like one of his last credits is Navy SEALs, which is a terrible movie, but it got famous thanks to Clerks for being a terrible terrible movie. And
really, so Clerks, which was a video hit, made Navy SEALs, which into a video hit. by osmosis.
I don't think it did. Do you think anybody saw Navy SEALs after seeing Clerks?
I thought that's what you just said.
No, I said that it got
famous as a bad
famous,
movie.
Infamous for being terrible.
Infamous. Oh, I see. Okay.
And it could very well have a good score because, I mean, this guy's pretty good.
Yeah. And he carries a lot of those montages.
He does a good job with those montages. And I think that's it for Mannequin right now.
All right. So, Terminator 2.
Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Yeah, what can be said that hasn't been said before? I guess we may as well be topical and compare it to our impressions of Terminator Salvation so far. They're on different planets, of course, but just from, you know, just sort of superficially, because, well, for one thing, the color scheme, and this is something I've noticed first, but the second Terminator a lot, and the first Terminator to a good degree, has a lot of cool colors in it, a lot of blues. And when they show the future, it takes place, it's sort of like black and yellow because of fire everywhere. But even a little blue. I mean, they're blue movies. And then Terminator Salvation, which takes place in the future, is very arid and deserty. And I remember, like, you know, if people, Terminator 2 is so weird because it's such a definitive closer of a sequel. But, you know, at the same time, people wanted another Terminator movie. And it was just a matter of when. And then finally they're being franchised again now. You knew people anticipated the future from what they saw of it in the first movie and what they saw of it in the second movie, which just in that like opening scene is like just by itself is so much more amazing than so many other movies that have been made since then that take place in some kind of war-torn dystopic future. The war-torn dystopic future in Terminator Salvation now is very like deserty, arid, maybe to look like the Middle East these days. But,
and it looks like it looks very similar to the third Resident Evil, even.
And yeah.
So I haven't seen Terminator 2, I guess, in 9 years, 10 years, long time.
Yeah.
Like, the last time I would have seen it would have been on Laserdisc with the special edition Laserdisc. So just, and I've seen Terminator a little bit more recently. And so it's kind of amazing what Cameron does at the open. Before we're padding Mannequin, and we don't have to worry about padding Terminator 2. It's at the open, because, you know, Terminator 1 was a hit and it made Arnold, but it wasn't that big of a hit. It got to be a bigger hit on video and that sort of thing. I mean,
it was a hit for Schwarzenegger, James Cameron so much. Well, except for getting to make Aliens, but then he's taking longer between movies. It's so amazing what he gets in just before the opening credits even start with that.
Now, I mean, I saw it in the theater, 70 millimeter, you know, when it started. And one of the things was at the beginning, it was amazing that he was showing grown up John Connor. And it still doesn't feel right that you know what John Connor looks like. In some ways, and I think that, you know, Cameron gets kind of because of what happened with Titanic. I don't think he gets recognized for being as kind of ballsy as he is, because not only did he show John Connor, he didn't make it. I mean, who would have been a good John Connor in 91 for a joke? He didn't make it Mel Gibson. You know, he had the balls to make it just some guy who probably was in an Old Spice commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always like that. But, I mean, that opening where he gets in the future that we only saw for a second in the first one, but then he expands on it, makes it huge. It's just
it's sort of, I mean, I remember in your recent review of the first Terminator, you didn't like the future scenes as much. You felt like they distracted from the first one.
Yeah,
or
the first
missing,
one.
They were missing something. They were sort of missing something.
In the first one, well, I think Cameron is, I mean, Aliens aside, because Aliens is different. Cameron is very much a Panavision frame director.
Yeah.
And I think that in the first one, it just would have been more interesting if you didn't know that Michael Biehn was a nut job until the very end. Whereas the second one, sort of the first half, does this beautiful thing where it plays on the audience's anticipations of a Terminator sequel in a way that sequels can't possibly deliver anymore.
I didn't catch that at the time, but yeah, some ads, the early ads didn't tell you he was a good guy. And then later on, after it came out, the ads acknowledged it, but they did, they sort of teased it all the way up until the release, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And I remember that before it came out, like, a friend of mine's mom was like, well, the shape-shifting one has to be the good one because, you know, there was like some logic thing that she had that it wouldn't matter if the bad one were
able to shapeshifter. Aren't shapeshifters traditionally, isn't that traditionally an evil superpower?
It is. I can't think of a good shapeshifter until Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and that is not very glamorous, I think.
And it isn't glamorous, like Plastic Man.
Yeah. You know? And so, and Plastic Man can't even shapeshift that much. He's kind of stuck as.
He's just got to have his face. He's got to have his face somewhere on that giant, you know, claw hammer or whatever.
And then immediately after the opening, well, the other thing that I really like about what Cameron's able to do with Terminator 2, which you never would have thought, I think even based on Aliens or The Abyss,
yeah,
he's able to turn what was essentially this sci-fi thriller. He's able to give it all this weight, this post-apocalyptic weight.
Yeah, it's almost, but not quite as visionary a jump for a sequel as The Road Warrior was from Mad Max,
right,
where it does reinvent the wheel to a really huge degree.
Yeah, and so I mean, he really, and
Aliens was, you know, a similar leap from the original, even
Aliens
though he didn't
was
do
a
it.
Similar leap, but I think that, and I think this is where I have problems with Terminator 2, is Aliens, he based his leap sort of on what Sigourney Weaver could do. And I think in Terminator 2, he relied a little bit too much on Linda Hamilton.
Linda Hamilton, she didn't marry James Cameron until 1997.
Are you serious? I thought they were married during this one.
No, they were married for 2 years, 97 to 99.
And then she didn't appear in Terminator 3 because of him or something? Wasn't that...
maybe. I believe it, yeah. Oh, wait a sec.
Well, then spouse. Wait. Was he with Gail Ann Hurd? Because he was with her for a while. I mean, trying to track James Cameron's romantic entanglements with his...
Actually... You know what? She was not married. She may have only been officially married from 97 to 99, but she had his child in 93.
Which would have been soon after filming. And
yep.
He puts a lot on her. And it's always been one of my problems with it is that it's awesome that even though he and Schwarzenegger skyrocketed after Terminator, that he brought in the original people for Terminator 2, but he's asking a lot of her, and I don't think she really can deliver it.
He's trying to make her as iconic as Schwarzenegger, and ironically, like, even Edward Furlong is sort of more iconic in the movie than she is.
Yeah.
Although she's for all that she has to do, I mean, she's really good, and what Cameron is sort of expecting of her is, like, a total transformational figure of strength, actually similar to the way Ripley is in Aliens as opposed to Alien, but more like the way Mad Max is in The Road Warrior after the first Mad Max, where it's like, if you see the second movie first, which
many people
are likely to do, and you go back and see the movie that came before, like, you see Linda Hamilton in the first Terminator, and she is pretty unrecognizable, like, even though as the same character. So I think he pulls off the transformation, but it's just, still, I think a little bit too much.
He pulls off
her.
The transformation pretty well, but I don't like when it shifts perspective to her.
Yeah, the part where she's like, you know, stalking Dyson and all that.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It loses its legging a little bit, and you're sort of waiting for the big shootout at Cyberdyne later.
And then
later.
You get it, and it's amazing. And that's kind of the thing about Terminator 2 is you know, the CG in Terminator 2, this is from an era when your only revolutionary technical director was Spielberg, I would say, in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what James Cameron used to be. He used to be the guy who came in and did amazing things, but he wasn't Steven Spielberg. And he's sort of
disappeared. But everybody knew the name Industrial Light and Magic. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That's not his, is it?
No, it's in ILM is Lucas's, and of course.
Yeah, my mistake. I'm confusing the two. I'm thinking of how him and Stan Winston formed a partnership, and they sort of made their names as, you know, the other big special effects studio,
I mean,
like capital letters to beat.
I don't think that, what was it, Dream Quest maybe was theirs? Something like that. Well, I think that ILM, I think Star Wars Episode 1 kind of ended anybody giving a crap about what ILM did anymore. And I think that's because of CG, really. You see crappy CG on the Sci-Fi Channel, and then it gradually increases based upon what you're watching, and it doesn't matter who does CG, as opposed to ILM, which was revolutionary and in that era.
Yeah.
And the difference between Cameron and Spielberg was that Cameron was ballsy, and you get the feeling that like post Titanic Spielberg is a lot more like James Cameron than pre Titanic Spielberg was, because I remember that in the '80s, he and George Lucas, you know, competed for bigger grosses. And I think that is definitely part of his thing. And, you know, he was always the big moneymaker, those two, until Titanic came along and changed James Cameron and changed everybody else. And, I mean, Avatar, Titanic.
Yeah, we're still waiting for the very first follow-up to Titanic.
And T2's the thing that made me, because I watched The Abyss recently. And I watched, oh, crap, I think I watched the special edition, which is just too long. Really.
Yeah, his special editions, I think the special edition director's cut of Terminator 2 is too long.
Yeah. Aliens is different because I know they cut that for the theater, right? I mean, the director's cut of Aliens
is 17 minutes longer, and I prefer that version because it acknowledges that Ripley's life as she knew it was lost. And it changes the pacing a little on the planet, but I mean, cause you see it before they get to it. But then beyond that, there's like, there's just more suspense sort
and
of
the guns basically. Is it?
Yeah. Those machines and some extra guns. Yeah.
And what's his face is in it for a couple seconds longer. Some of the other characters, the Marines are in it for a second longer, but no, I mean, so yeah, the last time I saw Terminator 2, that was one of the things that shocked me about this time is it moved really fast in some ways. And I think that because, you know, when it came out, I was 12 or 13 and it was a new Terminator movie and I read the novelization and all that kind of 1991 fanboy crap. And so I watch it now expecting to see the scene where they have to crush the chip that made.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so not seeing that and just seeing it move is kind of nice because the special edition really just slowed it down in
it's ways. It adds, I hate when Arnold is learning to smile.
Oh, that one when he does the scanning. Well, my thing is, how did he learn how to say I need a vacation?
That's the most egregious, the one thing you can't explain away.
But I think, well, the other thing I didn't realize when I you know, think about T2 is Robert Patrick's really good. Like, as a T-1000, he's really good. And I can't believe, I mean...
Yeah, it's...
Because he manages... I don't know.
It's easy to lose. I guess it's easy to lose sight of that. He's, you know, it's weird. I mean, so many, you know, memories go into the consideration of this movie that some of the parts are just so seamless that I can't even think of Robert Patrick as Robert Patrick.
And that, you know, he was unknown or he'd only been in a couple things, you know, he'd been.
And he hasn't, you know, broken out in any way since. No. So I just think of him as T-1000, and that's just to his credit. Then
he ended up on The Sopranos, right? I think.
Oh, did he?
I thought he did. He was in Copland. He was really good in Copland. Mm. And it was like I hadn't seen him in 5 years or 6 years.
It's such a like epochal movie because it's sort of the culmination of all the excessive 1980s pyrotechnic action with sci-fi, you know, with genre within a genre, and also makeup heavy and, you know, practical stunts and just everything that you want. And then it's got this thing that was like buzzed about more than the stunts at the time, which is a use of CG, as you know, pioneered by James Cameron, that suddenly starts reinventing everything like the next day. Yep. So it's the end of an era.
I'm trying to remember this, and I'm gonna get it wrong, and I probably should have Wikipedia'd it or something. I think the way CG started was they figured out a way to digitize and print a frame, but it was not for film. It was like for PowerPoint presentations. It's like for overheads. And then they realized they could do it with film, and that they could do, you know, and it's kind of sad that you watch The Abyss or T2, and you know, the CG isn't perfect because they don't know how to match the lighting yet.
Yeah.
But the CG itself is superior to a lot of the CG you see today. And it's kind of, you feel like
It's used in a way that makes sense, you know, I guess partially, you know, mainly because it was limited, because when they do like Schwarzenegger's face getting torn open in Terminator 3, it's CG.
Oh.
So, but it has like CG, you know, right, enhancement and stuff to add to it. But you notice that, and in Terminator 2 is an event where everything that doesn't need to be CG isn't, because they couldn't. And what it is CG for makes sense, because you have a shape-shifting liquid-type character, and that, you know, it makes sense in The Abyss, too, just conceptually, because it's water. Even though, like, water is supposed to be the hardest thing to do in CG, but it's magic water, and you know, whatever. you buy it.
Have you seen the Buster Keaton Three Ages?
No.
Okay, he ends up on a kind of a clay dinosaur at one point.
Uh-huh.
And my wife made a crack about the special effects, or maybe she didn't, but whatever. Because she likes Buster Keaton, so maybe she left that alone. But in that context, the clay dinosaur is fine. And in Terminator 2, some of the practical effects, yes, I can tell when it's not really Arnold, when it's really you know, it's the dummy they're taking down the hallway at Cyberdyne and shooting the face off of.
Yeah.
But it doesn't detract in the same way that your obscene CG does. Like, I think Dark Knight with the CG Two-Face.
Yeah.
That was just kind of like, okay, why can't he just have a freaking... You can't do burns. They've been doing burns for years, type thing. And Cameron really, see, I mean, I haven't seen Titanic, so I've heard the CG, and that's pretty awful, actually.
I remember thinking it looked awful on TV.
But I mean, True Lies is very practical. True Lies was, of course, you know, the James Bond movie that sort of made them rethink how they were going to make the next James Bond movie. I remember. Uh-huh. That changed how GoldenEye turned out, because, you know, Cameron had come along with this sort of very intense stunt heavy movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, T2 and
that could also feel light.
Right.
And have a light, yeah, light pace and mood.
T2 and that one, you know, it's kind of weird how there wasn't as much concern before about the stuntman looking like not being able to discern when the stunts were happening. I'm thinking of in True Lies when the stunt guy is running down the hill at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's very clearly, yeah, not Arnold. But, right, you know, suspension of disbelief still lets us just appreciate the stunt. And Terminator 2, the motorcycle scenes had some stuff like that at the beginning. And I think that Cameron kind of come to expect that with him. And it's kind of amazing he's only made, what, 5 movies? 6?
Yeah.
Because he's so... In some ways, T2 will never be topped in what it actually did. Like you said, it closed the 80s action movie, but it also, you know, brought in the idea of a
90s summer blockbuster, yeah, with CG.
Rated R, let's not forget.
Yeah. Rated R. Yeah, yeah, it's true. That's true. And then, you know, I guess superhero movies entered action movies into the PG-13 era, you could say.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's yeah, boy. Hey, how great was the old T2 arcade game with the Uzis? That was everywhere.
See, I always liked the Aliens game. Did you ever play that?
Oh, was that like a side scrolling?
It was a side scrolling one, and I once spent like $20 at an arcade winning it and like shooting, yeah, down the queen at the end and then discovering the power loader off to the right of the screen.
Oh, yeah, man.
And I'm like, you know, how many quarters did I just drop into this machine? But I mean,
you're supposed to go over to the power.
You know, I mean, T2 was a culture. I mean, it was a cultural phenomenon too. You know, with the video game, and because that's when video games were in every movie theater. And now it seems like most movie theaters do not have current video, yeah, games. And you know, there was the Guns N' Roses video, and what, Arnold liked Guns N' Roses or something was one of the things. And it was a big deal.
Yeah.
It wasn't
Hasta la Vista was, yeah, you know, originated there, not in the first one, but I'll Be Back was, and it was called Back too. And yeah, it's you know, I'm just reading that Schwarzenegger said at the time that like he'd never play another villain, and then I guess that's true unless you count Mr. Freeze.
Yeah. And I think I've read that it was Last Action Hero that made Schwarzenegger change the way he acted, and that's one of the reasons he was so upset when that one didn't do well. That apparently before Last Action Hero, Schwarzenegger acted for short takes and things like that. But, I mean, T2 is one of the first times that you really kind of take him seriously in being able to pull off stuff. Because, you know, Predator's not hard. Commando's not hard. Terminator,
well, just
2,
got this,
it's kind of, you know, neat.
Yeah, I, you know, on the one hand, I want to say that, you know, making him into transforming Arnold, basically, in that movie is an even bigger task than transforming Linda Hamilton, even though you can rely more on Arnold for screen presence.
Right.
But yeah, I can't deny I choked up a little seeing him go into the big vat at the end.
Yeah.
And when you kind of hate Cameron for getting you there, but he does it. And he gets the tone and everything right.
Yeah, and I mean it's because of the kid, obviously.
Yeah, Edward Furlong really helps sell everything, I guess, because. Yeah, you put the kid in. It's sort of taking a bit of looking into the future. It's like it puts a kid into an action. It integrates a kid into an action movie in a way that's been done many times since, and not just in the way of like kid cop movies, like Cop and a Half or something. But it like Edward, you kind of, you know, Edward Furlong is sort of believable in these dangerous situations,
right.
And. Yeah, it really helps sell the movie to kids, even though it's rated R. It was kind of the transitional thing, like, okay, this is how it's going to have to be in the future, because kids come to see these movies.
Exactly. And I mean, of course, there was the whole thing with Furlong, what they discovered him in an arcade or something.
playing games with Budnick, yeah, I guess.
So, and I think that, yeah, it's kind of just, and that, I think that just based on what Cameron pulls off in the first half, I think that what pisses me off so much about it is, you know, the highway at night thing, that doesn't do it for me. I think that he kind of went easy by doing the monologues and the voiceovers. And
Well, that was after ditching an ending where you see Linda Hamilton in old age makeup sitting in Washington, D.C. in the future.
Yeah, but, I mean, he ended Aliens so well. And
well, it ends on kind of a quiet note. I think Terminator 2 ends on a similarly quiet note.
It ends on a closing note, which, of course, makes the third one, which I still haven't seen, seem ludicrous, but it's kind of like the point of Terminator 2 is not the continuity heavy future war that we're going to see in Terminator Salvation or whatever.
Yeah.
It's that you just really watch this incredibly well-made action movie with some cool stuff in it. You know, I mean, that's kind of the thing is, you know, Cameron can, you know, give you a future nuclear apocalypse all he wants, but the Arnold Schwarzenegger having a robot skeleton underneath, that's kind of cool, right? I mean, like, it's cool.
Yeah, and that's the central image of the series.
Right.
That's why they still have the robot skeletons, you know.
I think that
robot skeletons is, yeah, it's, yeah, the little things go a long way. That's why the first movie is so cool in many ways, is that they had a small bag of really cool tricks that they parceled out on a low budget.
I was thinking, since this is our first new format podcast, we have to, you know, and Cameron presents a very nice way to throw back to our first podcast episode, in that Cameron used to paint matte paintings, including for John Carpenter.
Yep.
And
his name is in the credits of Escape from New York.
Yeah, and I remember that on the Escape from New York commentary, at one point John Carpenter's like, oh yeah, James Cameron, he painted that one, the food drop.
Yeah.
He painted the food drop. And it's kind of weird that Cameron has become a household name. And I think...
Yeah, I'm working on Piranha 2 is a little stranger.
He directed it or just wrote it?
Yeah, what am I saying working on? Directed it. It was, no other career has so inauspicious a debut, I think. Or, you know, unsettling.
Yeah,
a debut.
Unsettling, I think is the word. Okay, so let's see. We got a minute 25 on Terminator 2. It's like, it's so hard to watch it without, you know, especially since, you know, I know so much about the making of it. And it was so revolutionary at the time. It's hard not to watch it and just be in awe of what these guys did back in 90 and 91 with these special effects. You know, like the guy when he comes up out of the floor type thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's...
And when... Yeah. And it kind of comes... Sometimes when it's in big doses, it's when he's like pouring in through the helicopter. But the small doses, the little things, like seeing peaks of the Terminator skeleton under Arnold, the small things go a long way with him with T-1002, like walking through those bars at the hospital, or having that knife hand sticking into the husband at the foster parents' home.
It you know, it's kind of this subtle use of CG that we've kind of lost, I think, and that we had for a while in the 90s when they used it for practical stuff. And it was kind of, it's amazing that in T2, when they were doing the big stuff, they also thought to do the little stuff.
Yeah. And by the way, one more connection to James Cameron is that when he did the matte paintings for Escape from New York, he also, he uses Bad to the Bone. And that was something people really took notice of when you first see Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
But Carpenter used it first, I think, in 83 with Christine, very memorably.
Yeah.
And that was before people were really doing that a lot. And then, like, I guess after you know, at a certain point, Married with Children started using it a lot.
Yeah, after Terminator 2. Terminator 2, we probably can't even list all of the influences.
Yeah, exactly.
Now it might show up on a Family Guy, but at the time it was, you know, it changed.
Yeah, we're still basking in its glow.
It changed pop culture very much. And so we've run over. But I think we did pretty good for a half hour.
Oh, yeah.
Terminator 2.
So this has been an Alan Smithy podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt of cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew of the Stop Button. And I picked the two films for this one. And so Matt's going to pick next week's or next episodes. And they're going to be...
Next episodes. The good one is It's a Gift with W.C. Fields and Little Baby Leroy, 1934. The bad one is going to be Gymkhana. Where the skill of aerobics meets the kill of karate, 1985.
Directed by Robert Klaus, who I believe I've heard his name before. So.
Well, alrighty. We'll see you then.
Yep.
And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Stop.
Hey, folks, this is Matt of an Alan Smithy podcast. If you'd like to email me or Andrew with questions or comments, please email us at alansmithypodcast@gmail.com.
And if you want to follow the podcast's Twitter feed, which has all sorts of stuff, that's twitter.com/AlanSmithyPod.